To give some explanation and background knowledge for this whole encounter, I was around 15 when this occurred. I was camping out in the middle of nowhere with my family and part of my extended family. I was the oldest kid there in the RV, so you can probably understand how it felt to have no one else do the stupid crap I did back then. There was a good 2-year gap between me and the inferiors. It was almost like nirvana when I got to the campground and met the other teenagers. These were all people we knew fairly well from previous camping trips, so it was considered normal to hit it off with them from the start and act like we've known each other for a long time. Now, on to the story. My parents trusted me a lot. I like to have fun, but I also liked being home in time for dinner equally as much. So when I was gone for most of the day with other people from the camp, they didn't really think much of it. The only rule was I had to be back at the RV to eat dinner, which was around 8:30. So picture this, a group of 6 teenagers, all 15 to 16, out in the forest, with no adult supervision for the vast majority of the day. That is a recipe for success right there. But on this particular day, we found a neat deer trail that we had never seen before. On second thought, it didn't really seem like a deer trail. It snaked through a very thick part of the underbrush, maybe a foot of clear ground. It's a really hard thing to pick out of a brush, unless you're either looking or know where it is. Of course, it was promptly explored, marked with a broken branch outside of the entrance, and soon was forgotten. But I made note of a very small tunnel that was just off this trail. While we were all eating dinner, one of the adults proposed that we played manhunt out in the woods. Not everyone was totally on board with this idea, but in the grand scheme of the plan, they were all squashed down like autumn leaves. Everyone got a flashlight, and everyone was assigned to a team. For those of you who aren't sure what manhunt is, here's a brief explanation. Everyone who is playing is given a flashlight. They are divided into 2 groups. It's basically like a glorified game of flashlight tag. But there's a catch. As you catch people, you have to correctly identify who they are. And if you do, they can join forces with the hunters. The last man standing gets a candy bar or something, whatever is being offered as a prize. This is how we played it, anyways. For the first round, I got lumped in with the runners, those who are being chased by the hunters. We get a 5-minute head start. We can run, climb a tree, whatever the hell we want to do to evade the hunters. Usually, I'm the guy up in the tree, but that never really worked out as being much of a winning spot. So to try to score a win for once and use one surefire method of escape. The hiding spot was that small tunnel off the path that I mentioned earlier. It took almost the entire head start time to find the damn thing, because it was so well hidden and out of the way. As I passed hiding spots, I heard hushed, smothered whispering from the other runners who were questioning my actions. It should be noted that I have bat-like hearing. My ears were probably my greatest asset in this game. But when I'm approaching the destination, I hear the blast of the air horn announcing that the 5 minutes were up. I made this last-minute swan dive into a patch in the overgrowth, shuffling on my hands and knees until about halfway in, crouching down like some huge malformed quail. I then entered the tunnel. The hunters were doing their initial sweep through the trails, looking for obvious hiders, and people caught trying to change spots. When they finally got to me, they reached the dead end and went straight back. I tried to readjust myself and crawl further down the tunnel. I honestly don't know how this happened, but I found an even more hidden path. I dragged myself down the rabbit hole. Instead of ending in a dead end, this one ended in a slight hollow. I don't ever want to describe exactly what I found there, but I'll give you what I can. It was a young woman. She had no clothes on. She was in the fetal position, covered in lacerations and stab wounds. Her glassy, glazed eyes seemed to look straight through me. I won't go any further than that. I was too frightened to even scream. I froze on the spot as stains formed on my jeans. I was in a pseudo-catatonic state, like a marble carving for what felt like hours. I then heard someone else coming along the path. Have you ever been so scared for one moment that you consider something incredibly stupid as a viable option to escape? That was one of those moments. I let out a short, trembling whimper and started moving. Whoever was on the path stopped, and then eagerly started moving forward again. I could hear their panting, a horrible indication that whoever it was getting closer and closer to me by the second. By some wondrous, beautiful miracle, they missed the path leading to the hollow. I heard him moving down past the entrance, dragging something clunky and awkward behind him. After re-entering the small tunnel, I heard a low curse somewhere towards the other side. I then blasted out of the overgrowth. Cracks, crashes, and obnoxious rustling was all around me as I heard the man breathing heavily. The hoarse, deep panting was getting closer and closer to me, a testament of how I was too slow at exiting. Somehow, I emerged from the deer trail and started booking it down the trail. The unknown pursuer was close behind me for a bit, but it seemed like he was too exhausted to chase me any further. I know that everyone loves to rip on the fact that people always trip in horror films, but in all honesty, tripping is something that I am amazed I didn't do. It felt like an eternity, but I finally reached the main trail running back to the camp. I sprinted down it, screaming bloody murder. Confused faces looked out from the trees, and I think somebody called after me. Reaching the camp was easy, but trying to explain why I woke up half of the people in the camp and bolted out of the woods at breakneck speed was harder. When I finally choked out the words, I remember a profound silence throughout the group of adults waiting at the mouth of the trail. I really can't recall a whole lot from beyond that point. I know the cops came, and my mother and aunt ran shrieking and wailing along the trail, calling for the other kids to come back to safety. They rounded up everyone in 30 seconds flat, and barreled back into the camp. The police found a man in the woods, creeping along the trail, clutching a knife and a trash bag, with an assortment of sharp instruments found abandoned on the trail, some speckled and smeared with dried blood. I don't think there's any way for a kid to get over something like that. In fact, I still have nightmares sometimes of the man chasing me, breathing heavily down the back of my neck, trying to catch me. And sometimes, he succeeds. This happened when I was 5 years old. Unfortunately, I can't remember a lot of the details, but my parents helped me fill in the gaps. I was in daycare because my father was our main source of income, and my mother was just beginning to work her way up the ladder at her new company, so she could not afford to take any additional time off after her maternity leave was up. My grandmother would have to take care of me during the day when I was a baby, but my parents wanted me to socialize, so they found a local daycare. I initially had trouble making friends because I was a very shy child, but for some reason a girl named Bella insisted on trying to get me to play with everyone else. She managed to break down my walls, and we became best buddies. We remain close friends to this day. She was the most outgoing kid in our group, so she was friends with all the other children. One kid in particular, named Jackson, was always fighting for her attention. I was never fond of him. We argued a lot. The daycare teachers would often have to separate us. One day, Jackson and I were in a particularly bad fight, and our parents had to be called. Jackson's father showed up to take him home. I can vividly remember the moment he walked in. He was a tall man, probably around 6'3", and I can't exactly describe it, but he just looked off. Something about him struck real and genuine fear into me. I think it was because of how lanky and malnourished he looked. He almost moved like something pretending to be human. When they greeted him and explained the situation, they pointed me out. He looked at me with an expression that I still can't quite figure out. His face didn't really move much, but it seemed like he was going back and forth between anger and indifference. He just stared a hole through me until an obviously fake smile spread across his face. "Well, as long as there was no blood, I think we can let it go." His deep voice and his slow, drawn-out speech gave me the chills. He waved goodbye to me as he left with Jackson. After that day, he was always the one to drop Jackson off in the morning and pick him up in the afternoon. As if the first time I encountered him wasn't terrifying enough for me, each time he saw me, he would always have that stupid smile on his face and gave me a wave. About a month later, Bella's birthday was coming up, and her parents sent invitations with her to the daycare. Her family was particularly well off, so they threw her a big party in the yard behind their house. This will matter later on, but Bella's house had a patch of forest behind it. For some reason, their fence only covered the sides of the yard, so the tree line sort of served as a boundary for how far we could go. Seeing as we were all still quite young, all of our parents came with us. I had a great time for the first 15 minutes, until Jackson and his father showed up. It was almost like he had some kind of built-in radar, because he found me and locked his eyes on me within seconds of arriving. I spent most of the time after that in the inflatable bounce houses Bella's parents had set up. But eventually I had to go inside to use the bathroom. Bella's mom led me down the hall to the guest bathroom. For some reason, this door didn't have a lock. While I was finishing up and getting ready to wash my hands, I heard the back door open. After the door closed, footsteps began to move down the hallway. By some miracle, little me was smart enough to realize these steps sounded like the long, slow steps that Jackson's father took. I don't know for sure if it was him, but I couldn't fathom who else it could have been. I began to panic and hid in the small towel closet. Either Bella's mother had assumed that I was already done and was back outside, or he ignored whatever she told him because the bathroom door creaked open. The fear I felt in that moment of not knowing what was happening on the other side of that closet door is something I don't think any human should have to experience. I heard him opening the door all the way and stepping into the bathroom. He must have been looking around for about 15 seconds, but to me it felt like an hour. I heard him opening the cabinets under the sink. He moved around until the only place he hadn't checked was the closet I was hiding in. My heart was pounding at this point, and if I just hadn't used the bathroom, I surely would have pissed myself. I saw the shadows of his feet in the crack under the door. I'm assuming right before he opened the door, there was a loud commotion as the back door opened, and a kid was crying loudly. Jackson's father left the bathroom, and I breathed a sigh of relief. I waited for a while before coming out, quickly washing my hands and leaving. The commotion was over a boy whose name I've since forgotten. He had run into another kid without looking and had fallen onto a pretty sharp stick. Once I was back outside, I was on high alert, constantly aware of wherever Jackson's father was. Oddly enough, he seemed to forget about me. He didn't look at me, and just socialized as best he could with the other adults. Bella's party is in early December, so this was around the time of year that the sun was starting to set really early. Once it started to get dark out, we played hide and seek. I guess I regained my courage because I had forgotten all about Jackson's father and ran into the trees to find a hiding spot. We designated a line that you couldn't go past, so I found a bush that was just barely in bounds. I listened to the other kids whooping and hollering as they were found, and watched what I could from my spot. This bush grew in a very odd way, so I was almost able to climb inside of it. It was only partially covered from above, and mostly covered on its sides. Bella's parents yelled that once we were finished, we should come inside and watch a movie. Most of the parents, with the exception of Bella's father and two other men, went inside. I guess they were out there to keep an eye on us, but they weren't paying a lot of attention. I must have been one of the last hiders remaining at this point. It was very dark out now. Bella's mom had brought flashlights out for the seekers. The seekers were now beginning to move closer to where I was, because I could see them every now and then. I overheard one of them saying that the trees were the only spot left. There was the sounds of twigs snapping, and the crunching of the now long dead autumn leaves. I thought for sure it was one of the seekers about to close in on my spot. I tried to be as still as I could, and blend into the bush. I then heard two more sets of steps approaching from different directions. These were fast and light steps coming from my left and right. I was trapped. They had formed a triangle around me, and were unknowingly about to surround me. It then hit me that the steps behind me were not only out of bounds, but they had also become almost silent as soon as the two sets on either side of me had appeared. I had just assumed they didn't realize they were out of bounds. Just then, through the bush, I could see one of the seekers in front of me. I then looked behind me, but it was too dark to see anything. Just when I was about to turn around, there was a sound off to my right. Something had hit the ground. The seekers darted off in that direction, chasing what they probably thought was a hider moving in response to their position. I watched them go, and then looked over my shoulder to see what the seeker behind me would do. Quiet steps began moving in my direction. They were sort of circling me, seemingly always positioning a tree between themselves and me. I could hear them moving in, but I couldn't see anything. Something about the rhythm of these steps was off. I noticed that they were slow and deliberate. It was like they were making it a point to be very quiet. I looked over my right shoulder and thought I saw movement by a big tree about 15 feet away from me. From that vantage point, that person would have had a clear view of me. Just then, it occurred to me that the movement I saw was someone moving behind that tree. That's when it occurred to me that it could have been an adult hiding. But there were no adults playing with us at the start. So did they join in later on? I heard the seekers moving around and started to take an inventory of all the adults. There were only three of them outside and the rest were inside. Just then, I remembered Jackson's father and realized that I hadn't seen him at all since we began playing. Right when this occurred to me, the footsteps quickly approached, and right when I was about to turn to see what it was, a hand covered my mouth and an arm wrapped around my upper body. Jackson's father had gotten me. He sat down and pulled me back into the bush. I was squirming and trying to break free, but he was too strong. He got right in my ear and whispered, "No one will ever find you." I began to cry and scream into his hand, but it was no good. I reached down trying to find a rock or a broken root, something, but there was nothing. He grabbed me harder and forced me to be still when one of the seekers began moving back in our direction. I knew that I couldn't let this one last glimmer of hope go to waste, so I began searching again for something to alarm them. I reached behind me and realized that I could get into his pocket. And one move, I quickly grabbed his phone, yanking it out of his jacket, and then threw it a short distance away. It hit the ground with a thud, and the kids ran toward us. Jackson's father let go of me, and I exploded out of the bush. The kids laughed and tried to taunt me that they had won, but I pivoted and ran towards the house as fast as I could. They had no idea what was going on, but they followed me. Bella's father caught me by the shoulders and asked me what was wrong. I tried as hard as I could to explain, and I guess he got some semblance of what I was trying to say, because the three men immediately stormed off into the trees. Jackson's father went running off, and they chased him, but couldn't catch him. My parents immediately brought me out to the car, and we went home. That night I had a lot of trouble sleeping, as I thought every sound and shadow was Jackson's father. I was listening to the passing cars in our neighborhood. Eventually I heard a car stopping just outside of our house. I only heard one of the car's doors closing, so perhaps it was the teenage boy that lived across the street. There was silence for a while, until a sound at our side gate startled me. We have gates on either side of our house, which access the backyard. I thought maybe it wasn't the gate. I bet our neighbor's dog is jumping on the fence to try to figure out what my neighbor was doing out there. But then I heard footsteps quietly approaching my window. My blinds cover most of the window, but there is a small gap at the bottom that they don't quite reach. The sun peeking through always woke me up in the mornings. I was too scared to look. There was silence for a moment, and then there were fidgeting sounds. All of a sudden, the window was forced open. Something pushed through the blinds and onto my floor. A horrific, tall shadow figure unfolded itself and stood over me. The scream that erupted from my mouth was unlike any sound I have ever produced. I backed into the wall, still shrieking. The figure laughed at me. I reached out on both sides of me almost as if I was trying to melt into the wall, when I felt something with my left hand. Earlier that night, I had been so scared that I got out my wooden baseball bat that my dad had given to me and placed it in the crack between the bed and the wall. My dad was a semi-pro baseball player, so my childhood room was fully baseball-themed. I grabbed the bat and swung it at shoulder level, which happened to be even with the figure's crotch. Suddenly, that deep, bone-chilling laugh turned into a bellow of agony as the figure collapsed onto my floor. My dad practically broke down the door and turned on the light to take in the scene. There I was sitting on my bed with a baseball bat, while Jackson's disgusting creature of a father was lying on my floor, clutching my first two home runs. My dad got me off the bed and out of the room. My mom then took me down the hall and into their bedroom, locking the door. My dad turned back to face the pitiful sight on my floor and threw in a few more kicks for good measure. Apparently, when he ran off from Bella's party earlier that night, he then got in his car and sped off. He then waited in the woods until he saw us drive past, then followed us home. We were all too frantic to even notice. Once he found out where we lived, he returned later that night. Thankfully, after this last incident, he was arrested, and nothing like this has ever happened to me again. Despite Jackson's father receiving a very hefty sentence, we moved away. I just couldn't handle living in the same place that I experienced something so traumatic. Fortunately, Bella's family was also about to move. We didn't know this at the time, and we ended up in the same city, so I still got to grow up with her. I'm 19 years old now, and I still sleep with the TV on because of this. Outside of that, my life is unaffected by my experience. I guess the moral of the story is to teach your kids to be vocal about things that bother them, and to not brush them off when they say that there is a monster in their room, because there's always a small chance there just might be one. I used to work at a daycare, from the mornings until 3 p.m. I would watch after the very small children until the elementary school kids arrived. This took place a few months ago. The daycare I worked at had a basketball court at the base of a hill that was situated next to a major road. I had taken our fifth graders down to the basketball court and everything was fine at first. I'm watching over the kids and occasionally glancing at the road because although we're separated by two different fences, a dedicated individual could climb over both. The daycare was located in a very wealthy area, but we did occasionally have some homeless addicts wander into the parking lot. You never know what those kind of people could do. I got distracted, trying to defuse an argument that had broken out between two of my boys, when a few kids ran to the fence and were waving frantically. So I turned to look, assuming that they had seen some other teacher leave. Instead, I saw an unfamiliar gray car with the hazard lights flashing. The passenger window was rolled down, and a woman with red hair was leaning over the driver's side seat and waving at the kids. I shooed all the kids away, not liking this uneasy feeling I got. They all assured me that they knew who it was. It was an old teacher, but from what I heard about previous employees, I didn't recognize her, and at that point I had been there for about a year. The woman made eye contact with me just for a moment. She didn't appear to be threatening, but she did look remarkably unhappy. After what felt like a lifetime, but could have been no more than a few seconds, of her just staring daggers at me, she drove off. The entire situation felt very bizarre, so I called for an administrator on the walkie-talkies we had. My supervisor and the assistant director of the daycare came shortly after, and I explained to them what happened. They called over one of the boys who greeted the lady. He again explained it was an old teacher who used to work there, and she would drive by and frequently stopped on that road to say hello. The director asked him to describe her, and when she listened, she frowned and said that she was going to check the cameras. After closing time, the assistant director told me that there had never been an employee there matching that description, and she didn't recognize her or her vehicle on the cameras. She couldn't catch the plates of the car, so we didn't have much information to give to the police. Not to be too dramatic, but this story freaks me out, because this woman had stopped by the daycare enough for the kids to recognize her. It's also very unsettling where her car was positioned on the road. We have plenty of cameras filming the entire property, and many of them catch that road, but she always parked in such a way that none of our cameras could catch her license plate. It felt very deliberate. For clarification on a couple of things, we did notify the police, but we never heard back from them. And even though I don't work there anymore, I do still have a few friends who do work there. The woman has not been noticed since last November, which is when this happened. I have no idea what that lady is up to, but I hope she never returns. I grew up in Central Florida as a child of divorce. The separation between my parents was not a smooth one. In fact, it was a nightmare. The mid to late 90s was not a good time for my family. The year was 1997, and I was 5 years old. I had to attend daycare down the road from my mom's job. Since I was very young, I don't remember a whole lot of what happened, but I can piece together the fragments of what I can remember and my mother's recollection of the events. One day all the kids were playing outside. I had this very faint memory of running around the yard, playing tag with the other kids, I found myself running toward a wooden bench before blacking out. I woke up in a room inside of the daycare sometime later. I could hear my mom talking to someone in the hallway outside. She was very upset, borderline hysterical. I remember that she would sometimes talk this way with my father, and I knew that she would take this tone because something bad had happened. I tried calling for her, when I realized that I couldn't speak properly. There was one of those tall mirrors in the room. When I got up and walked over to it, I saw a bandage that was right below my mouth, covering my chin. My 5-year-old self couldn't quite put 2 and 2 together. In other words, I don't remember getting a boo-boo. So, I removed the bandage and was absolutely traumatized to see my bottom lip literally hanging off of my face, exposing the bottom row of my teeth. Everything is a blur beyond this point, but I had to get 2 separate surgeries to repair my lower lip, which the daycare foot the bill for. To this very day, there's a tiny scar on the inside of my lip. As a father now myself, I cannot imagine what my poor mom went through that day. She was already dealing with a bunch of other problems at the time, and then had to come to a daycare center to see her son had literally busted his lip open. This story happened in September of 2007. I live in Lyon, France. I was 18 years old when this happened. I was taking a train back to my hometown from the south of France. I had visited my grandparents in the countryside before beginning my first year at university. I left on a Sunday at around 7 p.m., and I got on the inner city train. Here's a detail that will be important later on. The train was one of those old slam door trains. This means it was possible to open the door while the train was still moving, no matter how fast it was going. It also seemed like this train didn't have any cameras. Once I got on the train, it was mostly empty. As expected, it didn't have any air conditioning, but I couldn't afford the high-speed train tickets, so I would have to endure. About 30 minutes into the trip, the train made its first stop. 3 shady-looking men boarded the train, and I was instantly creeped out. The 3 of them looked like they had just escaped a mineshaft explosion, and they were staring at me like I was a sirloin steak, the kind that costs more than $100. I decided to go into the next car and use the bathroom. But right after getting out of the bathroom, the 3 men surrounded me. They all had knives. One of them then yelled at me,
"Give us all your fucking money or we're throwing your ass off the train."
I froze in fear, and out of nowhere, one of them struck me in the back of the head. And then they dragged me to the door of the train. One of them opened the door and tried to kick me out while the train was still moving at high speed. Half of my body was out of the train, and I was trying hard to fight them off and prevent them from pushing me onto the gravel. I was screaming at the top of my lungs. I thought I was going to die. Suddenly the train began to slow down. All 3 of them forced me off the train, and I landed onto some grass next to the tracks. I got up and started running. Once my adrenaline died down, I was processing what just happened. There was definitely something wrong with my leg, something I hadn't felt until that moment. It turns out it was fractured during the fall. A bystander happened to see me being thrown out of the train and called an ambulance for me. And before I knew it, I was in a hospital bed. The police later caught these 3 crazy men, and they were sentenced to 3 years in prison, along with a huge fine. Yeah, I know. 3 years in prison for attempted murder. And this is France. This is just how things go here. But at the end of the day, I'm just glad to be alive. A long time ago, during the pre-internet era, I worked in a local pizza place. I was only 17 at the time. It was a nice operation. The staff and management got along well. Try saying that with a straight face nowadays. One of our servers was a lovely young woman. We'll call her Brittany, who was very much a free spirit. She didn't own a car and would walk to work and would get rides home from other co-workers after her shift ended. She usually worked the late shift and closed up at around 10, usually leaving at about 11 after cleanup. I often gave her a ride home on the nights I didn't bike to work. She would sometimes even hitchhike home if no one could drive her. She was pretty fearless, but always kept pepper spray and a small knife in her purse, just in case. On one busy Friday night, we finished the post-shift cleanup at around midnight. We were the only two left at the very end aside from the owner, who was in the office counting the cash drawers and cataloging the sales receipts. Remember, this was before computers, so this had to be done with an adding machine and pencils. I rode my bicycle that day, as it was really nice outside for the first time in weeks. The owner said that she would give Brittany a ride if she waited until the accounting was done. It would be about another hour or so. She decided not to wait and said that she would just hitch a ride home. We both tried to discourage her from doing that, and I told her that she might not even get a lift in an hour anyways. But she just laughed and said, "Hey, I'm a nice-looking girl with great legs. Somebody's going to stop, and I have myself a defense kit." Honestly, I don't think her penknife would have even cut an apple, but it was something, and the pepper spray she used would at least be effective. I walked her outside, and we talked for a while in the parking lot. She joked about sitting on the handlebars of my bike and saying that I could bike her home. Of course, that wasn't an option. So we both laughed. I offered to stay with her until she got a ride. But she said no thanks, and that no one would stop if they saw her with a guy on a bicycle, and that it would have made them suspicious that we were up to something. So we said our goodbyes and headed off in separate directions. She didn't report to work on her next scheduled day, which was the following Monday. This was highly unusual. She was never late for work, or missed a shift without calling. A couple of days later, her mom came in, frantically asking if her daughter had been to work. She hadn't come home or called since Friday night. If she was coming home late or staying at some place, she would always call her mother. We were all freaked out a little bit. Her mother eventually reported her missing, and the police came around and questioned both me and the owner about that Friday night. The owner, being a middle-aged woman, and me being a goofy 17-year-old kid, didn't interest them much as potential suspects or even persons of interest. After the police left, the teasing started. Restaurant workers can be a hard bunch, especially the kitchen staff, and most have a very dark sense of humor. At least the ones that I worked with. This went on for the next few shifts, and things didn't help when it became evident that I was the last person to ever see her alive. The cops came back into the pizza place and questioned me again, and also my parents, which of course freaked them out. Finally, about a week after she went missing, a coworker was really giving me hell about it, telling the waitresses not to get too close to me, or they might disappear. I finally had enough of his underhanded remarks. After he sarcastically asked me where I hid the body, I snapped back. "At the bottom of the fucking lake. You want to join her?" Of course, everyone who overheard this went, "Ooh," and egged us both on. Being 17 and stupid, I said, "Yeah, I put her on the handlebars, rode out to the dam, and threw her off. Now shut the fuck up and leave me alone." That quieted everyone down. He ended up calling me a few names, and we eventually returned to our duties. Well, Brittany's body turned up in the reservoir. She had been sexually assaulted and stabbed to death. There was a reason her body wasn't discovered sooner, but I can no longer recall why. Needless to say, the cops got a whole lot more interested in me now, after that sarcastic tirade at the restaurant, where I unknowingly foretold almost the exact way her body was discovered. They had my parents bring me into the station, and I was questioned again, without an attorney present. Back then, unless an arrest was imminent, a juvenile could be questioned without one as long as a parent was there. As the dam was a good 20-mile drive from the restaurant, I was eliminated as a suspect. They made an arrest a short time after that. It was a man they had suspected in a similar incident the previous year. He confessed to both murders in exchange for a life sentence. Obviously, there was no connection between me and him, but I still felt awful. When I went to Brittany's memorial, I just sat in the back quietly. By that point, word had gotten around about my morbid joke that turned out to be true. I didn't attend the burial service. I didn't want to upset her family. A few years later, I got work at a gas station and had the misfortune of selling an arsonist the fuel he used to set his own house on fire. But that's a story for another time. For context, this took place almost 2 years ago. I was 26 at the time. I was in Washington on sort of a vacation visiting my then fiance. It was for a graduation she was having for basic training. It was a big deal for her family, and she asked me to be there for it. So I said why not, and booked a flight. I would be arriving a week before the rest of her family, so her and I could have some time together, just the two of us, before she would be busy having all of her family there for the occasion. She stayed with me at my hotel during this time, and eventually we decided that we wanted to get out and explore some of the nearby historical sites that Washington has to offer. I had never been there, of course, so the idea piqued my interest. Once we arrived at our location, we spent about 4 hours walking around and seeing all the sites, from the Lincoln Memorial to the Washington Monument, the Congress Building, and even the White House. It was a very fun and exciting experience for myself to see all of these places, as I had missed out going on a school trip in high school to visit them. Sarah at the time seemed to appreciate my interest in them, and we basically enjoyed ourselves. After we finally decided that we had had enough of walking around and were ready to go back to the hotel, we used the Uber app to call for a ride. We had used it before to arrive and had no issues, so we decided just to use it again for the ride back. Sarah made the request on her phone while I sat down under some shade and waited. I was pretty tired from all the walking we had done, and I could feel that I was ready to get back to the hotel for a nice long nap. Eventually, after about 10 minutes of waiting, a car pulled up in front of us. Sarah mentioned to me that this must be our Uber, as the place that they had stopped at was not a parking spot. I stood up and followed her to the car, where she opened the back door and stepped inside, asking the driver, "Hey, you're the Uber, right?" He gave a slight nod to her without saying anything, and I then followed her into the car, shutting the door behind me. Now looking back on this, I realize how dumb we were. We should have been asking for the driver's name and verified it on the app. I didn't have access to any of this myself, as Sarah was the one who had made the request on her phone, so none of these concerns occurred to me at the time. As we both sat in the back seat of the car, which was a gray-colored van, the driver didn't say a word. I found this a bit odd, as any other Uber driver we had had would at least greet me once and confirm my name and the address I was supposed to be driven to. But this guy? Nothing. The vehicle began moving without the driver acknowledging either of us, other than that brief nod he had given to Sarah. I did pick up on how weird it was, but I was tired, and I didn't really feel like trying to engage the man myself. I laid my head back and just closed my eyes. I then felt a tap on my arm from Sarah, after what felt like only 5 minutes into the ride. I opened my eyes and looked at her. She didn't speak to me. I could see the look on her face was one of worry, and it had me wondering what exactly she was concerned about. He then pointed to her phone, which was showing the route the Uber would take to drive us back to our hotel. It didn't take me long to realize that we were heading in the opposite direction. I could see the color in Sarah's face drain. Shortly after, a notification popped up on her phone saying that our Uber had arrived, followed by a message from the driver asking where we were. The picture that popped up on Sarah's phone did not match the driver of the van. My heart sank into the pit of my stomach. I then knew that we had gotten ourselves into a situation I never thought that we would be in. I slowly looked back towards the driver, but I didn't say anything. I didn't know what this man's intentions were, or what he was capable of, and I honestly did not want to find out. I just knew at that moment that I had to get us both out of this van. I leaned forward and told the man that we had changed our minds and would be fine with being let out where we were. This was an attempt to get us out of the situation without alarming the man that we knew. He glanced at me through the rearview mirror, and the first actual acknowledgement of me since we had gotten into the vehicle. I caught his glance as he stared at me without saying a single word in what felt like minutes. It was probably only about 10 seconds. He didn't stop the van, and he didn't say anything in response to me, and just kept driving as if nothing had been said. My patience had run out, and I knew that whatever this man had in store for us wasn't good. I then did the only thing I could think of in that moment and reached into my pocket, pulling out my pocket knife I always carried on me. I flipped out the blade, and without wasting another second, I told the driver, "We know that you're not the Uber. I don't know what your plan is here, but I have a knife, and if you don't pull over right now, I'm going to stick it right in your temple." The driver's eyes quickly looked at me again in the rearview mirror, and I knew he could see me gripping the knife in my hand. He then quickly pulled the van over, and I heard the doors unlock. Sarah and I wasted no time getting out as fast as we could. The moment we were both outside, the man sped off. We quickly took a moment to gather ourselves as Sarah was having a panic attack, and I was still trying to wrap my mind around what the hell just happened. Sarah quickly pulled out her phone and responded to our actual Uber driver and informed him of our location and asked if he wouldn't mind picking us up. The Uber driver arrived a few minutes later, and this time, we made sure it was the right one. We told him everything that had happened. He then informed us of something that made the blood in my veins turn to ice. He told us that there had recently been multiple instances where people were posing as Uber drivers in that area, as it was easy to find many tourists around there who wouldn't think twice about getting into a car, thinking that it was an Uber or a Lyft. The guy told us that we were very lucky to have gotten out of that. We made it back to the hotel without issue, and quickly reported this incident to the local police. We gave the description of the unknown driver and the van he was driving. The police told us that they would call us with any further information, but we never heard back from them, so I'm assuming the man was never caught or found. That worries me because he could still be out there, doing this to somebody else. Again, I realized how stupid we both had been, and how we didn't verify the vehicle before getting into it. But let this be a reminder to everyone listening to do just that, and always make sure you're aware of your surroundings. My husband used to date a beauty queen title holder of a well-known pageant before he and I got together. They broke up before we met. She was a statuesque blonde very tall, and an absolute knockout in my opinion. This is important to the story. While she was a dazzling pageant winner on the outside, on the inside, it was a very different story. She could be charming and beautiful if she needed to be, but mostly, she treated people around her terribly, including my husband. And one day, he eventually got fed up and broke things off with her. However, she never went away. She would continue to call and email him repeatedly, even after my husband and I met. If anything, her calls increased. She would call over and over again, day and night, even after my husband, then boyfriend, blocked her number. She would ask for money and would threaten to go to the police and claim that he abused her if he didn't give in to her demands. He never gave her any money, and this infuriated her. The threats continued and became more malicious. When that didn't work, she would switch tactics. She would then sweetly ask him to help her with certain projects she was trying to get off the ground, or more accurately, have him do all the work for her and she'll take all the credit, with the promise that if he did this one last thing for her, she would go away. My husband knew better and did not reply, so she soon went back to being malicious again. Anything for attention, or for what she really wanted from him, money. My husband became terrified because, of course, while he never did anything to her, it would be her word over his, and he was terrified of ruining his reputation and career. We unfortunately ended up at an event she also was attending. She had been waiting for us to arrive, and had placed herself near the entrance of the event. As we walked in, she stood across the room, looking me up and down, laughing and whispering into the ear of her date, making it a point to try and make me feel uncomfortable. But that was fine. It was easy for me to ignore her. Until she ambushed me as I came out of the bathroom. She had clearly been waiting for the moment when I was alone. She was very tall, and she towered over me. For context, I'm 5'5". I had no intention of getting into it with her, and I hurried past her to find my husband. But she kept pace beside me, hunched over, so she was at my eye level. She looked like something straight out of a Tim Burton film, hunched over with that crazy demonic smile.
"Watch your back, pug,"
she added, grinning. She liked to call me names like Pug, because I own a pug, and I guess she thought it was an insult. What I didn't know is that while I was in the bathroom, she walked over to my husband while he was talking to someone, and had thrown her arm around him as if she and my husband were together. My husband unwrapped himself from her and told her to get lost. She then beelined it and waited for me outside of the bathrooms. We stopped going to parties after that night. The last time we ran into her was at a funeral for a mutual friend. She followed me around at the wake, as my husband was talking to the man's widow. I was talking to another friend and his wife. She walked right up and stood with us, joining us in mid-conversation as if she were part of the group. It was unnerving, but also just bizarre. But this was a funeral, and I didn't want to make a scene. I silently picked my glass of wine off the bar and walked away, leaving her with the couple I had just been speaking to. She stared at me with a smirk on her face. All in all, annoying but manageable. However, the emails and calls never stopped. She would call my husband over and over again, night and day, even though he had blocked her number. She would also drive by our house. Once I found my car keyed after leaving it outside for a night. Obviously, I couldn't prove it was her, but my husband and I knew who it was, and enough was enough. My husband had a lawyer send her a cease and desist. After the first, she called him from a private number. He answered and she said,
"Hi, it's me."
like they were the best of friends, and he hadn't just sent her a legal document demanding that she stay away from him and his family. He said nothing and hung up. Another cease and desist was sent, then a third. Nothing would make her go away. She couldn't handle that my husband was capable of not wanting her. Eventually, she became infuriated that my husband was not giving in. So she decided to take this rage to the internet. I knew that she was checking out my social media accounts, but I didn't really use them much, so I didn't care. She created a fake Twitter account and tweeted out that my husband was a fraud. She then tagged his colleagues, friends, investors, family members, every single person she could think of to try and ruin his reputation and career. We went to the police, armed with the threatening emails of extortion and false allegations. She was charged with 2 counts of harassment, and a restraining order was put in place. To our shock, the next day our phones were buzzing. This story had made front page news. Clearly, it was a slow news day. Her day in court came right before the COVID pandemic. We arrived to the courthouse and sat down. She walked in. We were shocked by her appearance. Gone was the statuesque, dazzling blonde. She had apparently shaved her head and was wearing a short, ratty brown wig. She had gained about 80 pounds, give or take, and was now sort of hunched. With her height and new weight, she looked like a linebacker. To add to her new look, she wore a bulky brown men's overcoat and a scarf tied over her wig, like a babushka. My immediate thought was, her outside now matches her inside, but her eyes is the thing that I noticed the most. A year earlier, we showed a picture of her to our kids, which should give you an idea of how long this was going on for, saying that if this woman ever approached them, they should run. At the time, my son, who was very young, commented that she had mean eyes. Maybe it was because she changed so much physically, but her dark eyes had narrowed into deep, black slits. As she scanned the courtroom and saw us, she would turn around every so often to look back at us and glare. She would then whisper into her lawyer's ear and laugh as if she were having a grand old time. She had a pair of big, round, cheap sunglasses that she would put on and take off intermittently. When she addressed the judge, she would put them on, and he promptly asked her to remove them. We thought she was putting on a brave face and treating all of this like a joke, but we were about to find out. Getting arrested would not slow her down. The restraining order didn't seem to faze her at all. If anything, it angered her even more. From then on, she would post from multiple fake social media accounts photos of myself and my husband. She would post a photograph of my husband with a caption, "pedophile," and other terrible names. To give you a slight idea, she posted altered pictures of my husband, photoshopped to look like he was wearing heavy makeup, and referring to him as a, quote, pre-op transgender. She posted more altered and unflattering photos of myself, calling me old and ugly. Those are just the G-rated ones. There was a lot worse. The name-calling, while obsessive and gross, wasn't what bothered me the most. Although, I'm not going to lie, hundreds of photos of myself on her fake Twitter account, obsessively pointing out every single preconceived flaw, did succeed in dragging me down at times. So why did I keep looking? Part of it was my own morbid curiosity, glimpsing into a mind that was unraveling. But also she could have dropped hints if she was planning on doing something else. Because it wasn't just her insulting posts that were concerning. There were sinister captions, like, "Keep an eye on your kids because I'll be watching. Why don't you plant some flowers in your front yard? Be good to your kids because you never know what could happen."
How was your Uber Eats order?
She would post photos of me with an arrow directed to my head, which I figured was some kind of threat. She posted pictures of my husband's workplace, which he was not allowed to be within 2 blocks of, in accordance to the restraining order. But the police said that this could just be a picture she took from the internet, which was a complete cop-out. She would share these Agatha Christie quotes. Every killer is usually someone you know well. Your end is near. Her profile picture was taken from a movie called Stalker, like she was in on the joke. We called the police again, but they said that there wasn't anything that they could do since she didn't directly tag us. I took screenshots of everything. Most of her posts were photos of us on this fake account. We never managed to get it shut down. I became anxious every time my kids were outside shooting hoops in the driveway. My elderly mother wouldn't take the baby out in the stroller. She was too frightened. The situation affected all of our lives. Things were becoming dramatic. Mrs. Beauty Queen taunted us with posts that said, "Catch me if you can," while posting close-ups of her dog's genitals or a piece of dog shit with my name beside it. The implication was obvious. It still bothers me knowing that she had a dog, since I didn't think anyone like her was capable of caring for anything. The calls then started back up. This time, our home line. Yeah, we still have one of those.
"Bitch, karma will get you."
And then made this weird chant-like sound, as if she was reciting an incantation. Sure enough, she posted photos of a pentagram with candles and the caption, "Ring, ring." Finally, the police asked us to come in and give statements. We gave them a drive containing thousands of screenshots of posts that she had made. They arrested her again and charged her with 2 more counts of criminal harassment. She would frequently mention our kids in a very ominous way in her online rants, calling them rude names, which I won't repeat here. My husband was furious at this point. I just wanted to get this over with. The judge also issued a social media ban for her. By the time she was arrested for the second time, her fake Twitter account had over 16,000 tweets in a 3-month span. She had no followers, so they were just mostly to herself. At this point, I kid you not, I felt weird walking into my own kitchen at night to make a sandwich, feeling creeped out that she might be outside watching. I put nothing past her, as there's nothing more dangerous than a desperate woman who has nothing to lose. That was one of the quotes she posted. I have no idea what was wrong with her. From what I researched, it's possible she is a malignant narcissist with perhaps some other mental issues at play. I wanted to mention that we heard from a reliable source that after my husband broke up with her, she allegedly became known to the police for other reasons. While my husband dodged a bullet regarding her threats to go to the police saying that he abused her, apparently, other men have not been so lucky. We'll end this story with a quote from one of her posts. Some of her online rantings were done in her native language. This had to be translated into English, which is why it is strangely worded. It was a statement to let us know that she enjoyed this drawn-out court process. "Violent women, and the cruelest, never answer questions. They like to continue the misunderstanding indefinitely. So I seek to contact people only to torment them. My cruelty is my last attachment to the world." It was the fall of 2007, and I was living in New York. I was a competitive athlete in high school, the type who got up before school for workouts and trained for long hours. With recruiting season a year away, I was under tremendous pressure to perform in my sport, as well as in the classroom. At the time, I was struggling to keep up in calculus, so my mom suggested a tutor. She made an appointment with a teacher friend of hers who really knew this stuff. I had been going to him on a regular basis, about 3 times a week for a month, before I ran into Alex. Alex had a tutoring session after mine. We had crossed paths every week. It had never been more than a glance and a smile, as I was incredibly shy and terrified to talk to boys. He was tall and blonde with piercing blue eyes, so naturally, I thought he was very good looking. One day my tutor had to change his schedule and decided to book us together, as we were learning the same topics in calculus. I was shocked and delighted when Alex started chatting with me after the class and asked me for my number. I had never had a boy pay attention to me in that way, and I was flattered that someone that attractive wanted my number. Eventually, Alex and I began dating. Alex went to Catholic school in another town, but he lived in the same town as I did. He took the bus every morning from my school to his. This gave us most mornings together, and he was able to meet my friends. I was a bit taken aback when they didn't take to him like I did. They mentioned him seeming weird, and I got super defensive, but I eventually let it go. I realized that I had been spending less time with them than I normally did, and assumed that they were just jealous that I had a boyfriend. As time went on, things became more serious, and I eventually lost my virginity to him in the back of his Ford Escape. That's when things began to change. While Alex and I always talked regularly, he started getting over the top about staying in contact with me. He would make me stay on the phone with him all hours of the night, until eventually my mom started taking my phone before I went to sleep. This relationship began taking a toll on my athletic career. I was too tired to spend any extra time training, and I began skipping my practices to see him, driving 30 minutes each way to his school. Eventually, my friend sat me down and told me how unhealthy this relationship had become. I had isolated myself from them, and my entire free time was spent with Alex. At this point, I wanted so badly to end the relationship. I had fallen out of love with Alex. College applications were approaching. I had been scouted by 10 schools. My plan was to attend Brown University, my dream school. Alex's obsession with our relationship had taken a huge toll on his grades, and Brown wasn't going to be an option for him. I remember telling him that's where I planned on going, and he freaked out, saying that he would never be accepted there, and begged me not to go. At the time, I was also recruited by the University of Illinois. Alex applied there, in hopes that I would ditch Brown and go to Illinois with him. That was the final straw for me, and I ended things with Alex for good, and I assumed that was it. I still had to see him, because Alex would take the bus from my school to his every morning. I remember walking into school past him and his classmates, who rode the bus with him. One of his friends called me a slut as I walked past. Apparently he had spread a rumor that I was cheating on him. I tried to ignore it, but that's when I started getting messages on my Facebook from random people who went to his school. I spent months getting nasty messages accusing me of having STDs and telling me that I was going to get gangbanged. Eventually, I had to shut down my Facebook because it wouldn't stop. In retrospect, I think deleting my Facebook was what set off the stalker tendencies in Alex. He wasn't able to see my face online, so he started calling me non-stop and sending me desperate emails saying that he loved me. While this was going on, I was the favorite to win the high school championship in my sport. I had gone undefeated all season. Alex ended up showing up while I was competing for the championship, and I saw him there. It shook me up so badly that I ended up losing. I was furious and heartbroken. I ended up answering one of his calls later that night and screaming into the phone, telling him to never contact me ever again. That's when the threats began. I got a call a few nights later from Alex, after he texted me, saying that he had something important to tell me. Stupidly, I answered. He began to tell me how he was going to kill me. He was going to show up at my house when my parents were at work, with a rope and knife, and make me suffer like I had done to him. I began to cry. He went on to say that he was going to get me before I went to college. I was driving my own car at this point, and he said he knew where I parked every morning, and my parents were never going to find me. I decided to record what was being said, and had it taped on my phone. I hung up once I felt he had said enough. The next morning I went to school extra early, much earlier than I figured that he would be there. I showed my advisor the recording, who then called my mom. I remember feeling a deep-rooted shame as my mom listened to the recording, like I had done something to bring this on myself. My advisor was so alarmed by the recording, he advised me to go to the police. My mom and I were in the police station all day, explaining the story of my relationship with Alex and how it got to this point. The police then drove to his high school and arrested him while he was in class. The topper on the day, though, was when I went out to bring food back to the police station for my mom and I pulled into the parking lot at the same time that Alex arrived there in a cruiser. I saw him in cuffs, and he in fact did look like he wanted to kill me. Post-arrest, we got a restraining order against Alex, and he was sent to a mental institution to be evaluated. He did end up breaking the restraining order on more than one occasion. I contacted the police, but they didn't think it was cause to do anything about it. I think it's important to note that Alex's family was very wealthy and was well known in the area. It's not really surprising that they tried to brush this under the rug. I ended up attending Brown and had to inform them of the restraining order to let them know that Alex should not be allowed on campus. It's been over a decade since this all happened, and I still continue to receive phone calls and friend requests from Alex. I recently moved across the country from where this all happened. I finally feel safe now that I'm far away from Alex. But anytime I get a blocked call or a text from a number I don't know, a thought goes through my head that it's him. It's safe to say that this experience has changed who I allow into my life and who I choose to date. I'm a female. This happened when I was 13, so I was fairly naive at the time. I was a major introvert and only had a few friends in my school. I wanted to be more social, but I naturally preferred to be alone so I could read and write. In early November, I was added to a group text from a few of my friends and a couple more numbers I didn't recognize. The group was planning on hanging out at a park near our school that night. My parents would never allow me to go. Luckily, they were heading out for an overnight trip, and they wouldn't be back until 4 in the morning. Everything fell into place. My parents left around 8 o'clock. I ran out the door and made my way to the park. The one thing I made sure to do before I left was lock the door. My folks are very paranoid, and that was the biggest thing they ingrained in me. Once I got to the park, I noticed a creepy figure standing near the edge of the forest. No one else seemed to notice it. I already had a reputation as a weirdo who was obsessed with true crime, so I didn't mention it. The night went on, and I was having a lot of fun, ignoring that sinking gut feeling I had. Every so often, I would look over my shoulder, and the figure was still standing there, watching us. It was around 9:45, when 4 out of the 10 people there had to leave because of curfew. It was getting cold, and it was nearly pitch blackout, with only a few streetlights on. The rest of us decided to leave as well. The park we were hanging out at has a field that was fenced in with only a few exits. The front of the field faced an empty road, with either side bordered by forest. All of the group except for me were being picked up by cars. I didn't want to ask for a ride because my parents might find out, And of course, the figure reappeared by the exit I had to take to get home. As I walked, I tried to steady my heavy breathing. I didn't want to be paranoid, but all the true crime I had listened to was catching up to me. The man was probably in his early 40s or late 30s. I would say he was around 5'9", with dark hair and a beard. He stood about 10 feet from the exit. When I got close enough to it, I ran for about 30 feet through the exit and into the forest. Once I felt safe enough, I just started to quickly walk through the woods, at least until I got to the road. I heard a branch snapping behind me. I stopped walking for a second and quickly checked over my shoulder. Around 15 feet behind me stood the man. He was walking slowly, almost as if he was trying to not seem suspicious, but it only made my fear intensify. I turned back around and began jogging towards the road. I lived about 10 minutes away from the park. After about 7 minutes of jogging, I was in my neighborhood. I knew that I could run the rest of the way if I had to, so I checked to see if he was still trailing behind me. To my horror, he was only 5 feet away from me. He had kept pace this entire time. I ran faster than I ever have in my life. I could hear his footsteps pounding on the concrete behind me. I dove down an alleyway I knew well, trying to lose him. I could hear his heavy breathing as he tried to keep up. As I ran up the steps, I looked behind me. He had just arrived at the bottom of the porch steps when I managed to unlock the door, burst through it, quickly closing it behind me, just before he threw his entire body against it. I ran around the house, locking all the doors and windows. I turned off the lights and hid in my bedroom with a kitchen knife, just in case he managed to get inside. Fortunately, he didn't. If this was a better world, this is where my story would end. I never told anyone about what happened, since I didn't want to get in trouble with my parents for sneaking out. My loner status returned. I began writing fictional horror stories as a coping mechanism and never went out past 7. It was around February when a classmate of mine was sharing a story of some random man following her home from her bus stop. The man that she described was the exact same man who had stalked me and chased me home. Another female student had a similar story. I didn't join the discussion, but everyone knew that there was some weirdo stalking girls outside of our school. As time passed, everyone seemed to forget about him, and I eventually moved on from it myself. I was getting ready to go to school when my mom pulled me aside and showed me a picture of a man. She told me that this guy had been arrested 2 weeks ago for sexually assaulting a child and had escaped from the local jail, and to call the cops right away if I saw him. I was shaking the whole time because the picture was of the same man who had followed me home that night. It still haunts me to think what he would have done to me if he had caught me.
There's always a reason to be afraid.